You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Send in your nominations now for the APN Awards. The APN Awards celebrate the best in archaeology, heritage, history, anthropology, museum, and cultural podcasts from around the world. Open to independent, academic, institutional, and network-produced shows, the awards recognize outstanding storytelling, research communication, production, hosting, and more. Award categories include Podcast of the Year, Best Educational Podcast, Best New Podcast, Best Interview, Best Storytelling Episode, Best Host, and several fun APN-only awards for those shows hosted on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Send in your nominations before the 1st of August 2026. Public voting will then be open from the 1st of September to the 1st of October 2026, and then will culminate in a live awards show on the International Day of Archaeology, so October 17th, 2026. Find out all information and send in your nominations through the Archaeology Podcast Network website. This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 57 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Mathilde Siebrecht.
And I'm Jessica Van Dam.
And today I'm savouring a very different kind of tea to my usual, which is a rose green tea.
Ooh, that sounds lovely.
It's very like floral and yeah, very good. And it makes me want to try, you know, we were talking last episode about making our own teas. We've got so many roses in the garden now and they are really pungent in their smell. They smell really good. And I think that if I dried some out and put some, mix some with some green tea, that would be a really nice tea.
Ooh, that sounds great. That's a good idea.
Yeah. So I'm thinking that might be my activity for this weekend. And what are you savoring today?
I'm having basically a standard builder's tea, except that Yorkshire teas, they had a toast and jam one and a biscuit.
What? Both
excellent. So I'm having a toast and jam at the moment. So it's like your standard English breakfast, but with like a slightly like jammy note to it.
Like a berry sort of sweetness or...
Yeah, I think strawberry was probably their aim. So it's a little
fascinating.
Like
I didn't realize that Yorkshire tea did like alternative flavors.
Yes, they also have a nighttime one that's a decaf with vanilla and nutmeg, I think.
Ooh. Yeah.
Very nice. That's
interesting, because I know the classic Yorkshire tea. And when I was in York for a conference at the end of last year, and they gave us, you know, the golden Yorkshire teas in all of our conference bags, and it was fantastic. So I had my Yorkshire tea every day. But I didn't realize that they had... my mind is blown.
Yeah, you'll have to try them. They're very good. I had to import them from when I lived in the UK.
Oh.
So I don't have a lot left. But
interesting. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going to...
The biscuit one is really good, too.
A biscuit, but what kind of biscuit? Like, all sort of digestive?
Yeah, I think that was probably the idea.
Interesting.
But for those who are not from Europe and the UK, by biscuit, I kind of mean cookie, but not a very sweet cookie. That's
true, because for you, biscuits and gravy is something else, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're like, they're almost a scone. They're not even a, it's like a little baked good. It's not a cookie.
That's so interesting. Yeah, biscuit.
Yeah, there's no like good comparison that I can think of, actually. You just have to know what like a digestive...
You don't have biscuits at all in the US.
Not like the same kind. Because like, you know, you have like your chocolate chip cookies and you're like other cookies.
But they're different, yeah.
And then you have crackers.
But they're
trying to think if there's like... Yeah.
But they
don't think if there's anything like... I mean, you can find a hobnob if you know where to look, but... And I do know where to look.
That is fascinating. It's so funny how many things you don't even think about as being so culturally... obviously, you know that like tea and biscuits is very British, but like you have biscuits in everywhere in Europe. You'll have some kind of biscuit. So it's interesting that there's no biscuits in the US. Fascinating.
Yeah.
My gosh, we're only 4 minutes in and I'm already learning so much. But as much as it might seem so, the theme of this episode is not actually biscuits. It is the next in our Everyday Archaeology of Cutlery special. And this episode, we're going to be talking about spoons.
I love a spoon.
Yeah, good old spoon. Which, what is your first thought that comes into your head when you think of a spoon?
That I have weirdly specific requirements for spoons for different purposes.
Oh, okay.
So like... I love a teaspoon, which is not the unit of measure. It is just a small spoon, but it has to be a specific shape and a specific size, and it can't be too big because then it's too big for the mug. It's very specific. Also, different types of soups need different shaped spoon.
Interesting.
I don't know what to call that part of the spoon. I probably should have looked up parts of the spoon.
The bowl.
Yeah, no, there's different shapes, and I hate a soup spoon. I find those really annoying.
The big, they're like round, right?
Yeah, they're too deep.
Too deep?
Yeah, the soup, like a soup spoon is too deep to like comfortably, unless you're not talking about a ladle. No. Like, maybe this is an American thing. I don't know.
I can picture you trying to eat a bowl of soup with like a ladle and going, this is too deep.
This is too much. Well, no, because then you could just like sip on the edge of it like a cup. That would make sense. But like when you shrink that down into a soup spoon, and then it's too, like you do have to like sip off the edge of it because it's too deep. Whereas like other spoons, you can like easily fit it in your mouth.
Although that's the whole point of a soup spoon, is that it was supposed to just be sipped from, because you would have, the soup would be too hot. And so you would transfer it with the soup spoon, and then you wouldn't be able to take like a massive gulp of it. You'd only be able to like slurp from the outside edge of the spoon. And that would mean that it would be cool enough to eat.
Ah, see, that makes sense.
There you go.
I think I just don't like slurping.
Okay, that's fair. Are you also a non-tea slurper?
Yeah, no, I don't slurp my tea.
That's fair.
I mean, unless like I'm like inhaling it or something.
That was, my old flatmate used to hate it when I slurped my tea. And I didn't even mean to do it. It's just, if it was really hot, you just have to kind of go, you know, and then...
Yeah. And I say, you just have to wait for it to cool down.
No. We got places to go, people to see.
No, I'm enjoying my cup of tea. It's a leisurely activity.
Yeah, I should probably, maybe that's, you know, what I need to do, what I need to learn is to...
Yeah, take a minute.
I shouldn't have my soup spoon to cool down my soup as I'm drinking it, and I shouldn't slurp my tea. Should just
enjoy. Okay. It's fine. To be fair, my mom also inhales her tea when it's too hot, and it also does the like, you know. Exactly. And I'm like, no, can we just wait?
From now on, whenever we start the episode, I'm just going to slurp my tea.
Well, listening back on the episodes, there is that like slurp at the beginning, and every time I'm just like,
right,
that's a choice you made.
Well, but that's because it's an audio format. Like, I have
what
to do.
You
I can't, like, you can't, how would you demonstrate drinking a cup of tea if you don't have the slurp when they can't see the cup of tea?
I don't know, maybe just like a clink, you know, of the teacup.
And as well,
like, yeah, or like the teacup and saucer. I don't know. It's funny.
Well,
I think it's funny.
I apologize to the listeners for any discomfort caused by my slurp at the beginning.
Or just skip forward 20 seconds. You'll be fine.
Exactly. You'll be fine. We're also taking like 5 minutes to chat about slurping spoons. So, I mean, it's fine. But,
well, I had to describe what I found offensive about soup spoons. So,
yeah.
So, what did you think of when you first thought of spoons?
I thought of wooden spoons, actually, because my husband carves spoons as like a hobby. He hasn't for a while, actually, but he used to carve spoons a lot. And we have so many spoons, so many wooden spoons lying around the house. But he also makes like different wooden spoons for cooking that we use quite a lot. And we use like a lot of different wooden spoons for different kinds of cooking things, not necessarily like, oh, this shape spoon has to be used for this or something like that, but just at a certain point, if you use this wooden spoon for tomato sauces enough, it turns slightly red, and then you don't want to use that for like vanilla milk pudding, because, you know, maybe it'll, even though it probably won't, because you've been washing it and it's not like the tomato is going to come out the spoon, but anyway, you have specific spoons for different specific purposes is the point I'm making.
See, and I agree that the, you know, even if it's like a found purpose for the spoon, they do end up having their own purposes.
Yeah.
Like in my house, we have like, they're probably like dessert spoons. They're like the smaller spoon of like a complete set of silverware. And to me, those are cat food spoons because the show are cat food with the little spoons. But sometimes my mom will use teaspoons instead of the cat food spoons, or she'll make tea with a cat food spoon. Oh, man, cannot have it.
See, we've also got a lot of little spoons which have like Minnie Mouse and Winnie the Pooh on them because they are my daughter's spoons. And heaven forbid anyone who has not been allowed to use the Winnie the Pooh spoon use the Winnie the Pooh spoon without permission of my eldest daughter. There will be a lot of tantrums going on if someone uses
it. I mean, it's sacred. That is a sacred Winnie the Pooh spoon.
But it's useful because you have a very specific purpose. And I always feel so horrendous when like other people come over who have kids and they're staying with us. And then they're like, oh, can I use this spoon? I'm like, please. Literally any other spoon in our kitchen apart from this Winnie the Pooh spoon, because
you almost just have to hide it at a certain point. Yeah, like, no, exactly. It has a special drawer in a special house.
I mean, now actually they're old enough that like they understand the concept of sharing and it's fine, but it was mainly when they were little and they were like, you know, the world is mine and everything in it is mine and no one else is allowed to have anything that's mine. Then it's very difficult to explain to them that like, no, look, they, you know, they don't have a spoon with them, they have to use one of our spoons. Like,
they don't have a traveling spoon.
Exactly. Although, to be fair, we always had travel spoons because you never know when you're going to need a spoon. Which also I have actually in my handbag. I have like a little wooden spoon that I always take with me everywhere. Because sometimes you're out and about and you need a spoon.
Which, yeah. Also, yeah. I would argue that the spoon is one of the most useful cutlery items that you can have.
Yeah. Oh, that's a big statement.
I know. Well, because, you know, you can kind of cut with the edge of it. Mm-hmm. Not as well as a knife, obviously, and not as well as like the edge of a fork, but like still. And then you can scoop most things.
Oh, yeah.
Most things are scoopable.
Yeah, to be fair. Which that leads on to my question, actually. So before researching for this episode, how much did you know about the history of spoons or the archaeology of spoons?
Almost nothing.
Yeah.
Other than I like spoons.
Yeah. No, that was the same with me. The only thing I knew about spoons is that in order to make them, it really helps to have some kind of curved blade, because if you are trying to make the bowl, it's more difficult when you don't have an actual like curved blade. You can do it, but it's a lot easier if you have either a really short blade or a proper curved blade. So
yeah, there's a guy I follow on Instagram. I'll try to find it so we can put it in the show notes. But he would video himself carving spoons all the time.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, it's so good. That I love a wood carving video just in general.
Yes.
But yeah, it was really pleasing.
Yeah. But so then obviously, as always, we have to look up the kind of oldest reference and sort of development of spoons throughout history. So we know that nowadays spoons can be used for everything from getting cat food out of a jar to stirring tomato sauce or stirring tea, as it would be, or fighting with your sibling over which particular Disney cartoon animal is depicted on top of it. But
very important.
How did they start? What is the earliest form of spoon? And I don't know about you, but I really struggled with this one because I'm not sure when the term spoon was actually first used, but you said you found a reference for it.
I did. I found it. So like the word spoon specifically and in English was 1259 while describing the wardrobe, like a wardrobe inventory of King Edward I.
Interesting.
Of England, presumably.
Okay.
But that being said, spoons have been used since ancient civilizations like the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Shang dynasty in China, which was around 1600 BC.
Yeah, so around a lot. And I mean, the problem is, I guess, obviously, text you mentioned, what did you say, 1259 was the first kind of written reference we have for it in English. But that's usually the problem with historic sources. Well, not the problem, all the historians are going to come at me, but like it's not a problem, but just, I guess, an issue when trying to find the oldest of anything is that usually by the time something is actually mentioned and described in a historic document, it's already been in use for a very long time. So, because you're not going to necessarily write about something as soon as it's, you know, invented or starts being used in that respect.
Right. I also think that like spoons specifically and like these kind of everyday household items are so everyday that no one's going to be like contemplating the spoon.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? No one's like writing a poem about spoons that I know of.
And actually, the only reference that I could find about it, like actual solid reference, are in the Bible in Exodus. And then again, you refer to the golden spoons or the kapot, apparently. Ooh. And that dates to around the first millennium BCE as well. So, you know, not too long after what you're saying as well. But indeed, that's like very specific kinds of spoons, which, yeah, is also. And I was trying to look it up and to see if there was any more ancient references to something. But again, this is what we talked about a little bit last episode. Trying to equate our modern vocabulary to ancient sources is really difficult. And I mean, sure, maybe I could go through all of these like ancient Sumerian texts in detail if I had the understanding of Sumerian language, and maybe I could find a reference to something that I could then interpret as meaning something that we would think of as a spoon. But it's not like they have a translation for the word spoon necessarily. Like it could be a ladle or a small bowl or, you know, something like that. And it's,
or even a stirring stick. You think of like a cauldron. Like, am I gonna like break out a giant spoon? Maybe. Yeah. But could I also just find a giant stick and stir it with that? Yeah.
Exactly.
And then would that become a spoon?
So like you have, for example, like in Mesopotamian, like administrative texts, and again, it's always administration. Like that's always the earliest step of anything is always like admin.
Record.
Yeah, right, record. I mean, like today we had 50 million spoons, but like it's from the third millennium BCE. So around like 2600 to 2300 BCE. So before the year zero. And that's like the oldest known written references to, I guess what we would think of as utensils. But even then, it's a very loose translation like of it, you know. It's a strong interpretation, I would say, and like nuances in language. So,
well, and I mean, we'll get to forks soon in another episode, but like the concept of utensil also changes where you are in the world. And like spoon may just not be part of that concept, but you might have like a stabby thing or you might have a cutty thing.
Yes.
But is it? Who knows? We don't know?
Yeah, true. I should mention indeed, like all of these episodes, to be fair, they usually are coming from, and this is a very, something that I say in nearly every single episode, but I'm going to say it again, interpretation bias, how we see the past and how we see objects is very dependent on our own cultural upbringing and our own cultural context. So of course, Jess and I came up with the topic of cutlery because we are both from, I guess, what you would consider Western countries. That's the term that's used most often, I suppose. Although west of what, one could argue, but anyway. And it's, yeah, so it's this, you know, we, and on our everyday life, it is considered normal to use cutlery, aka knives and forks and spoons, as our utensils to eat food with. So this is why we came up with this topic, right? In a lot of parts of the world, it is not considered normal to use knives and forks and spoons to eat with. And, you know, who's to say that it was considered that way in the past, as Jess just said. So I feel I should just highlight that and put a little bit of a disclaimer in the reason why we chose this particular topic, but also it is important to note where our bias as researchers comes from as well. So
yes,
there you go. Disclaimer over.
And we are not experts in this by any means. So
no, exactly. We're not cutlery experts. We are just, we are specialists in our particular area of, you know, artifact conservation and material culture studies, and that is where we are coming from with this, and so we're using our existing knowledge on that. But it's very important to note that this is a very broad podcast and we cannot possibly be an absolute expert in every single item that we talk about on this podcast.
But then that gives you, our listeners, the opportunity to say, hey, wait, I heard this other thing, or I actually am an expert in this, and then we'll go, oh my god, we have questions.
Come on and talk to us. Exactly. So this should be a two-way discussion. It shouldn't just be us preaching to you. This is intended to inspire you to think a little bit differently about the world around you. So hopefully it does that. Anyway, I think we should have a quick break to top up our tea. I also kind of now want to get a biscuit after we were talking about biscuits, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I had a very delicious biscuit with my tea. I hope that you're also feeling fulfilled, Jess, in your biscuit consumption.
I will have to go search for the biscuits. I know that there are some in this house, but where they are.
Find them in the break.
If you're interested and live in the United States, there is a shop called World Market, which I love. I highly recommend. Go visit it. But they have biscuits. That's where I get my biscuits now.
There you go. Also, World Market, if you're listening in and want to sponsor this podcast, feel free.
Oh, yeah. We'll tag you.
Okay, so we've talked about the kind of earliest written records for spoons and how they were used and when we start to see it emerge. But again, it's one of those things, a bit like knives, the whole definition of a spoon. And yet again, as with last episode, we have our handy dandy Cambridge Dictionary open. So according to the Cambridge Dictionary, a spoon is an object consisting of a round hollow part and a handle used for mixing, serving, and eating food. And I feel like compared to a knife, a spoon is indeed more often specifically like associated with food.
Yes. Yeah. Although I feel like one could be very threatening with a large enough spoon.
I mean, have you seen Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves?
Yes.
And he goes, I'm going to cut your heart out with a spoon. Why a spoon?
Why a spoon, my lord?
It'll blunt your food. It'll hurt more. So Alan Rickman at his best, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go and watch
classic.
It.
Classic.
It's a great film. It's horrendous in terms of American accented Robin Hood. Apologies
to all our US listeners,
but come on.
No, well, I fully admit, I never try to do British accents. It's a disaster no matter what. So like, absolutely. Well,
I mean, good on him, I guess, for not even trying to do a British accent and failing, but at the same time, like,
just a little effort would have been good.
Some kind of British actor to do it, or somebody could do a British accent. I also love how he arrives at the Cliffs of Dover and then later that afternoon is walking along Hadrian's Wall as if it's right next to each other, which,
yeah, that absolutely would have only taken an hour.
Yeah. Whereas it takes probably 6 or so hours to drive, I would say. No, more. Probably like eight hours to drive. So
probably,
you can imagine
yeah.
how long it would take to walk. I'm not sure how long it would take to walk, but you can imagine if it takes that long to drive. Anyway, sorry, slightly off topic. So point being, spoons. So the problem is, again, as with knives, what is a spoon in the archaeological record? If we're looking at the earliest evidence for spoons, how do we actually define it? Because actually, they reckon that probably shells were maybe used as an early form of spoon. So it was basically finding something that was a roughly spoon shape. And that was how spoons then evolved, right? Is because we wanted this sort of scooping shape. And shells, especially like seashells, are a beautiful shape for that. But shells are actually renowned for being very hard to conduct use wear on because they have so much natural wear and so much stuff that happens to them as they're forming and stuff as well. So it's really difficult to differentiate between the natural wear that a shell just has in its life and intentional wear, like more so than other objects and materials, I would say. So I'm always in awe of people who can do use wear analysis on shells because it is a very difficult specialism to, yeah.
I never thought about that. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It's the same with like antler and horn, because of course the deer uses its antlers a lot as well. So you have to be careful when looking at like the raw outer edge of antlers and horns and things, because just because you see use wear traces doesn't necessarily mean that's human use wear. It could be the animal. Yeah.
Life wear.
Yeah, exactly. So, which there are lots of like tricks to that, because you can basically then look at different parts of the object and compare the kind of use wear buildup and compare the natural outer of the tool and everything. So there, I mean, there are tricks that you can do, but yeah, shells are particularly difficult. Also speaking from experience, because I have looked at shell beads and it is horrible to try and identify, even trying to identify like if a hole in a shell is natural or drilled by a human. I don't know if anyone's walked along the beach, but quite often the way that shell beads, for example, are created is if you imagine like a seashell, like your classic seashell, like a clamshell type thing. And then there's like a little lump, right? Next to the hinge where it sort of opens and shuts. And if you grind down on that, at some point you'll grind down enough that it creates like a hole. So that's how a lot of the early cultures would create holes. It's like an easy way to create a hole on a shell, and then you have a lot of shell bead necklaces and things. However, that's also because it's the highest part of the shell, it's also the part that gets worn down the most. So sometimes you'll also just get naturally worn bits there, which then create a hole. And it's very difficult, especially when you're looking at like thousands of years old, to differentiate between that. So
yeah, that makes sense.
Anyway, point being, shells were probably like the earliest form of spoons, but it's very difficult to actually accurately identify that.
Again, makes sense. Also, I feel like the material of shells too, like just as like a, just in like a conservation, because it's an inorganic material, but at the same time, it was grown.
Right.
And like, so then, I don't know, like I feel like they wear down quickly. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Not that I've tried.
How would you conserve a shell, do you know?
You know, it hasn't come up yet.
Interesting. I'm
trying to think if I've come up across anything close. There's a lot of like oceanic jewelry and like clothing that incorporate shell elements. Mm-hmm. But those were, maybe the earliest one was like 18th century that I worked on.
Okay. Yeah.
But.
I'll still.
Yeah. But I don't think I had to fix any shells.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
Probably some sort of consolidant if, but there, but it's also like a hard material too. So then they should be pretty fine.
Yeah.
Kind of like
they do fairly well in the archaeological record. But it's just during their, it's not even their preservation in the ground. It's more just what happens to them indeed, like during their life, their lifetime.
Yeah.
But
I think that's what I'm thinking of. Cause like kind of like sea glass.
Yes.
Where the glass is like nice and hard and it lasts really well in the archaeological record. It also gets beat up in the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. Which, and that links nicely when we're talking about preservation of things, that's also links nicely to another issue with spoons and spoons in the archaeological record is because most of the time, until you start to get sort of copper spoons coming in, again, the ancient Egyptians, is the, and again, that's, as Jess was saying, that's probably just because they're the ones that survive, but that's not to say that other cultures didn't also have them.
Right,
here you go. A lot of the spoons were made from organic materials, which, as we know, everyone say it loudly, doesn't preserve well in the archaeological record. Well done. A plus.
Yay.
So then the problem is we don't actually have that many of them preserving, even though maybe they were using them all the time and maybe they were carving wooden spoons hundreds of thousands of years ago. Who knows?
Yeah. I also feel like spoons specifically are like a kind of shape that would break easily.
Yes.
Like I watch a lot of those mudlarking videos on the Thames of people like digging in the mud and like the ceramic pipes.
Yes.
The stems are always broken off the bowls of the pipes. And it's like, oh, I feel like spoons are the same. Like even if they're wood or something else that's not like metal.
Well, and what's interesting is the oldest properly dated physical evidence that we have for spoons come to what's known as the Bedarium period spoons from Upper Egypt, date to approximately 4,400 to 400 BCE, and they are made from ivory. So,
nice.
Quite exciting. And they're really pretty. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can see they're able to be viewed on the British Museum website, so you can have a look at them. But yeah, so we have ivory, which ivory does preserve a little bit better than bone, but still not great. And again, it depends on the preservation conditions. So as we were saying before, in Upper Egypt, in sort of drier and arid climates or in waterlogged climates, so depending on where it was in Upper Egypt, I'm not sure exactly what this site was. It was arid. Then it preserves a lot better, which means that it was able to be discovered. And again, though, I mean, the excavation report that describes them as spoons comes from 1928. So again, it's sort of implying that these are that because they look like something that we recognize. But for example, speaking of ivory spoons, there are these really fascinating objects, Paleo-Inuit objects, which are referred to as spatulas. And it's because they kind of look like little spatulas, but they also actually kind of look like spoons. So they've got like one rounded sort of bowl end, although it's not a bowl, it's flat. And then like a long kind of handle with a hole in it most of the time as well. But they're only like sort of hand width long, if that's to say. So like maybe 5 centimeters or so in length. So they're quite small and they're made from ivory or bone. And no one knows what they're used for, but they're called spatulas or spoons, but that's just because they happen to look like them. But, you know, again, using that word automatically creates that association and that implication, which it might not necessarily be. So
how wide is the little spatula bit?
Like 2 centimeters? 1 to 2 centimeters? Yeah.
Interesting.
I'll send you some pictures after this.
So I was thinking like, I don't know if you've ever seen these videos that have come up, but like ear cleaning videos where you use like a little spatula instead of like a Q-tip or something.
Yeah.
And so that's immediately what I thought of. I was like, oh, a tiny spatula for ears. Centimeters does not make sense.
Yeah, I think they're a bit too big for that. Yeah. But there's all sorts of, it's interesting actually, since I've seen them and looked at them, I've been chatting to loads of people about them who work in different parts of the world, and I've heard some interesting theories about them. So maybe we'll do an episode on that at some point because it would be kind of fun.
Love a mystery object.
I know. Yeah, we need to include some more mysteries of archaeology episodes in here, I think.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. But then it's one of those things. And as we talked about before, I feel like with spoons, it then just kind of developed. And at some point it became a little bit more standardized and a bit more formalized. And then now they're just like a very everyday item that everyone pretty much has some form of spoon, which is,
yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, they're a good shape and a good form for a particular purpose.
Yeah. And I like that they're so universal too.
Yeah, they really are.
Because like forks are certainly not universal the same way. And I just like that.
Yeah, no, spoon is, everyone should have a spoon. But, and in terms of, so we kind of talked about metals a bit already in terms of like how they corrode and things. But as we mentioned here, like spoons are also often made of like wood or other organic materials. So how would you preserve or like conserve something like wood or like a more degradable, shall we say, material?
So wood, it would depend on what the like archaeological context had been. So like in Egypt, if it was in Egypt, nice arid climate, keeping it in a dry environment is very important because sometimes the sudden addition of moisture can be like shocking to the wood, because wood reacts almost immediately to any change in humidity. So you can you can notice it with like your door, like if you have a wooden door anywhere like in the, like if you have like a humid summer, the door will like suddenly be stuck because the wood has expanded with the moisture.
We have one
and
upstairs,
then
and it's very annoying.
Yeah, exactly. And then like dry winter, it suddenly there's like, you know, a centimeter gap around the whole thing. And you're just like, but no, this didn't close a month ago.
And it would be useful now with this cold breeze to have a bit more of a stuck door rather than a massive gap.
Exactly. So that's kind of what the consideration is. If it was in a waterlogged environment, then it's kind of a matter of slowly drying it out in a very like careful and cohesive way. And then looking if the structure of the wood has been maintained or is truly waterlogged. So if you look at, we'll include them in the show notes, but the conservation efforts of, like, we talked about maritime archaeology in our intro episode a few episodes ago. And so like when you bring up a ship from a seabed or a river or something, it takes years to properly dry out a ship like that, because if you dry it out too quickly, the wood will warp and crack and disintegrate. And so I'm trying to remember what the big one is called that they've been working on for ages.
I feel like it's Mary Rose or something?
Maybe. But didn't they do that with the Batavia too? I don't know. Anyway, there's a number of them. We'll try to find links to some of them. But basically, they're like these ships have been brought up and then are constantly misted with water and sometimes with a consolidant. And so they've been having issues with some of the consolidants that they've used in like the last 20 years that they're like doing weird things now. And so trying to find, like, decide what the new stuff is to consolidate wet wood. And one of them is just like different types of cellulose, which is in plants. And so it's basically replacing plant material with plant material, which makes imminent sense.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
we should have an episode about that, actually, about like changes in conservation methods and stuff over time.
Oh, yeah. That'd be fun.
I'm going to add that to our list now.
Okay. Fantastic.
Sorry. Right. Yes. Moving on.
So that's with wood. And then with ivory, it's, so in the burial context, teeth survive the best out of any skeletal remains. And so ivory is like the second best because it is that hard, similar material. I think it's just straight keratin, basically.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm always trying to remember what things are made of. But it also is very susceptible to like very dry or very damp environments. So it doesn't survive great in like damp burial contexts, but in dry ones, it does pretty well.
Okay.
And similarly, preserving them is, it's kind of like wood. You kind of treat ivory like wood.
Oh, okay.
In a lot of conservation work.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then ceramic, there are ceramic spoons historically. And
it's true.
Especially if you think like Chinese spoons, like the
those nice ladles. Which I imagine ceramics are quite stable.
Yes, very stable. because they
find how many ceramics at work.
Yes. Like, yeah. No, they love existing.
The other material.
They love. Yeah. I mean, they like the unfired ones don't, obviously, because they kind of just return to clay if they get wet.
Yes.
But if they've been fired and basically like.
Like hardened, glazed.
Yeah. There's a proper word for that. I'll think of it. I'll put it in the show notes. Like melted, basically.
Oh, fused?
Yeah, fused. That's a good word. Yes. Because they've like the molecules have fused.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's no longer any sort of organic component left. And so there's nothing to corrode, basically.
Which is really interesting. There was a really fun material that we found at work, and I can remember, and if like my colleague and I were looking at it, and neither of us are ceramic specialists, and we were just like separating all the materials out. So a ceramic specialist was going to come along later and look at the ceramics, etc. And there were these bits, and we were like, is this pumice? Like, you know, the pumice stone, that really like airy thing? Because we were like, it was massive, this massive thing, but it was so light and it was just full of holes. But we were like, this can't be pumice. We're in like central Germany. Like, where would they get pumice stone from? And like, it was like, and anyway, and then luckily we have a conservator. Shout out to Celia, if you're listening. She probably isn't, but anyway. And she said, no, this is ceramics. It's just the particular kind of ceramic that it is has so much organic components that when it's fired, they all burn out. And so it's left with this like really porous material that really looks like pumice, which is incredible.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's very cool. Yeah.
It's very cool. I can't remember now what exactly the material is because, as I said, not a ceramic specialist, but it was cool. And now I recognize it every time it comes past. And I'm like, aha, this is ceramic. So I pop it in the ceramic box and then the specialists take over and do their thing. But yeah. But nice, but cool. So we've talked a little bit about the historic evidence. We've talked about the oldest remains. We've talked about how we would go about conserving spoons that we find. And of course, as always, end of the episode, I have to ask, what was your favorite new fun fact that you learned about this topic?
So I have two. So the first one that I found was just like a interesting, like, I wonder if it answers a question that I have. And it was basically that when the Americans went over to, or well, they weren't Americans yet, but when the colonizers went over to what we now know as America, they didn't have enough forks. And so they were like, oh, now we have to use knives and spoons. And so they would use their left hand with a knife to put food onto a spoon with their right. And then they would eat it.
That's why Americans use the wrong hand.
Weird. See, I think this is going to come up more in the fork episode, but I taught myself to eat the European way, which is to keep your left, fork in the left hand, knife in the right hand. But yeah, very interesting. So that was the first fun fact.
That just relates to, so in Germany, it's quite common to have the fork, if you're eating with the fork and knife, instead of having the fork like prongs down, you'll have the fork with like the prongs up, held almost like a spoon. And then that's how they use the forks. Like, maybe it's just my husband's family, but like, I have noticed a lot of people using forks like that as well. So that's also really interesting that even the same.
You kind of push the food onto the fork.
But also they use it to stab it, but just the other way. Like they hold it the other way. They hold it like a spoon to stab.
Oh, that's weird.
Like,
I flip my fork depending on if I'm stabbing or scooping.
Yeah, same.
Yeah,
but they hold it as if they're scooping, but then stab as well as scoop. So interesting.
Oh, that's weird.
Right?
Michael's weird.
So that was your first fun fact. Did you have a second one?
So that was the first one. And then I just came across one like right before we started recording, and I just had to bring it up because we're in the middle of the World Cup at the moment. So that's my new personality. And apparently, the wooden spoon is an award given to the losing team in some sporting events.
Yeah.
Like the Six Nations rugby tournament, which I never knew. I didn't know that you could receive a wooden spoon for doing poorly.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that's funny.
I had to.
And apparently it originated at Cambridge, where the student with the lowest math score would receive a wooden spoon, which also just seems like a nice
rubbing salt into the wound.
Yeah, like a consolation prize. Like, well, at least you could keep eating. Here you go.
I mean, I hope it was at least a nice spoon, like not just a bog standard.
The picture that came up, I saw it on the had like a little news article about it. So the picture that they had on there It was a very nice spoon. It was very big.
Okay.
Big spoons.
Okay. That's yeah. Good. Well, and speaking of nice spoons, my favorite fun fact is about Welsh love spoons, which we have several on our wall, and they've always been called Welsh love spoons. And I was like, what is a Welsh love spoon? I have no idea. So one of the oldest ones that is apparently in the Welsh Spoon Museum, it dates to the 1600s. But you have in the 6th century, you have the word, now bear with me, Llyw. Apologies, any Welsh speakers. My mum is Welsh and she told me this is how it was pronounced. But to be fair, that was about an hour ago before we started recording this episode. So it may be a case of that whisper game where, you know, you just, you hear one thing and then by the end of the hour, you're like saying a completely different thing. Anyway, that's apparently the Welsh word for spoon. Apologies, any Welsh speakers listening for my horrendous mispronunciation. And that word first appears in the work of Taliesin, which is a 6th century Welsh poet. And basically these spoons, the legend is, or the tradition around it, is that it would be carved by a young man as a form of wooing his intended lady. And yeah, so it was sort of to show your dedication and to show your admiration, you would create these beautiful decorated spoons and they would be presented to the lady in question. And if she accepted it, then that was her accepting your approach or whatever you call it, your advances. So there you
Ooh.
Go. That's my little fun fact.
Also, because I always think of the Welsh spoons as like the carved wooden spoons. But then when I was in Romania, I found out they also do a carved spoon.
Oh, there you go.
So, but they theirs are more like, they had like what was carved on it had significance. So like I bought one that had like a stork on a house because apparently it was really good luck to have a stork nest on your house. And so the stork would like protect your house. So if you have a spoon with a stork on it, it's supposed to bring luck to your house. And I was like, oh, that's lovely.
That is lovely.
Oh. Yeah. And for those of us who do not have husbands that carve them spoons, it was nice.
Well, I think that we have actually definitely run out of time on this particular tea break because we said a lot more about spoons. Well, we actually, to be fair, we talked a lot about things other than spoons in this episode as well, as per usual.
So cohesive.
But I hope that you listening enjoyed this little tea break and this little dive into the history and the archaeology of spoons. If you did, as always, please do like or follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Also, you can leave us a review. That really helps others to find the show and to learn all about it. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about spoons, you can find all of the links and the contact information in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.